Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Okay, here we are with Fire Marshal's Corner. My name's Ed Camo. Joining me is my co-host, Mike Love. How you doing, Mike?
Hello, how are you all?
I'm just doing great. Well, today's the international show, and you're kind of wearing two hats this month, aren't you, Mike? You're not only one of the hosts, but you're also one of the people being interviewed about your recent trip over there to Vietnam.
Yeah, and of course you suggested that maybe I should interview myself and make it more efficient, but I'm really interested to talk about the trip to Vietnam that I had the opportunity to take.
Yeah, and also joining us in the show is Dan Jones, who also just recently did a trip to Botswana over in Africa. So we're hitting a few continents here and talking about the fire service and fire codes and fire prevention and response and operation. So we really cover the gamut in the show here, so there's a lot to learn from both those. But then joining us, in, as I say, in Car Talk, perhaps in the third half of the show, is Mark Ghilarducci, who just a few years ago did a trip to Russia. And we don't have a lot of time to talk to him, but I did want him to come in and give us a little bit of an insight. And this is based on that nightclub fire in Russia that last reports killed 124 people. That's just unbelievable amount of loss over there. And there's so many parallels, too. I mean, you read the news reports. Boy, Mike, doesn't it just sound like the Station nightclub fire and even reaching further back, Coconut Grove?
Yes, and, of course, Coconut Grove, the anniversary, was on the 28th of November. And, you want to try to remember the lessons learned from those fires and review them again because history repeats itself.
It does. It does. And it just... We have to share this information as widely as we can, and that's one of the things that I think came out of the trips that all three of you did, both Mark, yourself, and Dan Jones, trying to share information, exchange information, so these tragedies just don't keep repeating themselves around the globe. So with that, why don't we get into the show and see what we can learn from around the globe. And joining us on the phone right now is my co-host, Mike Love, who's the Division Chief and Fire Marshal with Montgomery County Fire Rescue Service, and Dan Jones, who's a fire chief in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I appreciate you guys joining us.
Good morning, Ed. It's glad to be part of your program.
And good morning, Ed. Thanks, sir, for having me on again.
The reason having both of them here is that, besides the fact that Mike, of course, is the co-host, but Mike also just recently did a trip to Vietnam where he was over there at a meeting with National Institute of Standards and Technology talking about fire protection in Vietnam, and Dan was in Botswana, Africa, on a delegation trip over there. So we're going to be talking about both of those, and I think I'd like to start with you, Mike. Maybe you could fill us in a little bit on the trip you did over there to Hanoi and what it was about and what you saw and what you learned about fire protection over in Vietnam.
Okay, excellent. And, it was the first time I had ever been to the Far East, and so I was excited about that. It was just an unbelievable, unique experience from the time I started trying to obtain the passport and visa and all that. It really takes a lot of planning to do any kind of international travel, especially nowadays, with the concerns of terrorism and security and that kind of thing. Really first got involved in this program, it's the standards and trade that National Institutes of Standards and Technology has been doing since back in 1994, and it really is a reach out to developing countries or developing economies, because that's their focus, is economy and commerce. And they reach out to them and try to provide interrelationship, to provide assistance in creating and improving standards, which is, of course, their main area of function within NIST, and of course to create opportunities for the United States industry and business to use their innovation in ways to provide products to other countries that are developing. So really it's an opportunity always that they're looking for to create use for U.S. innovation and business to sell our products abroad. So that's really the basis for the program. And they've done a number of these programs, standards and trades workshops, to these developing countries in the areas of building and fire safety. They've done them in China. They've done them in the Mideast. This particular one is the second one they've done with the country of Vietnam. My first involvement with the standards and trades was in 2008 when I was a speaker on the program for Vietnam when they came here to the United States. And I did a presentation on how government's codes work within the code enforcement environment. And so, of course, these are only 30-minute presentations, so you really only have an opportunity to present an overview. And so that was kind of like my opportunity in to this program. And that being right here in the Washington, D.C. area, I do have a lot of involvement with NIST because of the local opportunity and not have to have somebody travel and that kind of thing. But when they asked me to join in on their planning for the trip to Vietnam, I thought, wow, this is a double opportunity. It would be my first opportunity to travel out of the country and also to be able to absorb some of this planning as well as the presentations for this three-day workshop, which was just Ed, I showed you the agenda for that. There were some outstanding people on this, and the program was really something that I would have gone to anywhere. So that was the program, and when we arrived in Vietnam, we had an opportunity for the first day to get a little bit of acclimation with the city of Hanoi, which is where the workshop was being conducted. And we went to, first of all, went to the organization, which is kind of NIST's counter-organization in Vietnam that provides standards and technology for buildings. And they're called the Institute for Building Science and Technology. And they had really just this decade secured and purchased their first testing equipment. They bought cone calorimeter. They bought earthquake measurement tools. They've got a whole lab that they're trying to get going on materials testing and so on in their own country there, so that they don't have to depend on others outside of Vietnam to come and do the work for them. The next opportunity we had that particular day was to go to one of the Hanoi fire stations, which to me, of course, was a real thrill to see how people do fire protection in other countries. And of course, the city of Hanoi is over 10 million people, and it's about 500 square miles in area. Very highly dense city with, you know, your usual problems that you have with a dense, highly activity city. And they had like 12 fire stations for this whole area. So imagining, you know, the fact that they were under utilizing fire protection and they have so much risk that's there. It was just phenomenal for me to understand how they were able to even keep people safe. The streets are clogged constantly with traffic, and it's mostly, of course, motor scooters and motorcycles. But the response time is you know, oftentimes as much as 30 minutes to get from the fire station to a fire. We met with a captain there in the Hanoi fire station, and these people actually are working for the police department. The police provide the fire protection in Vietnam under the organization of public safety throughout the country, and it's a nationalized fire service under the police. And the captain that we met with, and of course, you're dealing through a translator, so you know that throws in a different challenge as far as communicating with somebody. The captain expressed some of the same types of things, problems that we encounter here in the United States, and he talked about what he would like to have as far as training, and he really wanted to get a hold of some of the NFPA standards that he could, you know, really get into and start to implement some new innovations for them. So,
what was the built environment like over there in Hanoi, Mike? You know, old city, new city. What type of construction did they have over there that they had to deal with?
Well, in Hanoi itself, it's obviously they have to take advantage of the vertical environment. And it's not exactly high rise. There are some high rise buildings, but for the most part, they're upwards of 4 or 5 stories, jammed in. They're very narrow, but they go high, and they're made of concrete. But there's a tremendous amount of combustible materials in their environment. As I mentioned, it's a developing country, and what I understand from talking to others who have done a lot of international travel, especially to some of the Far East countries that are really catching on in the world economy, China in particular, is that in developing countries the entrepreneurial urge and movement is so strong that every street front space, every inch of space from the building line to the curb and beyond the curb into the street is used for commerce. Mm-hmm. And they're all, obviously small business people that are making, whatever they can make. So you may have within a 20 square foot area, you have a business that's completely open to the environment. So no real doors or anything. It's just open like a corral that you walk into and see the materials. Plus, the business itself flows out into the sidewalk, and then you have people with bicycles that are stacked with homemade baskets and all different kinds of craft type goods. And then you might have a person sitting on the sidewalk with a wok over a can with a fuel in it and is cooking, some sort of a deep-fried roll of some sort. And all this is going on within these little spaces, and these spaces repeat themselves over and over and over again as you walk up the street. And the reason I mention this is that if you remember in Mexico City, I believe it was last year, they had a fire set off by fireworks that ended up taking the whole block and incinerating this block very quickly. You have these potentials in some of these countries because there's no real separation between all these materials.
What kind of fire activity do they have? I mean, it sounds like almost a perfect storm of, like you said, high combustibility with a lot of ignition sources. What kind of fire activity do they get? Do they talk about that?
Well, the one thing, I asked the captain about that, and he told me that they run, he said, we run 25 fires a month. And I thought, well, that's not really, and this was just his shift. He runs 25 fires a month, and these are real fires. Mm-hmm. So in terms of for us, that's all they do is go to fires.
Right.
They don't do anything else. They don't do emergency medical type stuff. They may get involved with a collision or something, but for the most part, that's all they do. And so 25 fires a month just for his, shift at the fire station, that's pretty significant. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the travel time in a lot of cases, unless it's right next to the fire station, is going to be as much as 20 to 30 minutes. So
wow.
By the time they get there, it's a pretty well involved fire. So oftentimes it's a defensive type operations.
Mm-hmm.
The fire hydrants are only about every kilometer.
Wow.
So So they have a huge issue of trying to obtain a water supply to put the fire out. And oftentimes you'll see bucket brigades starting to form before the fire department can get the lines laid and get their relay going. So in this dense, built-out, high-traffic environment, they're trying to create their own water supply from the very limited water sources. So that in itself is a very big issue.
So, I mean, what are they using for codes right now? Because this sounds like it'd be a very difficult environment to impose code enforcement on.
Right, right. They are using, oftentimes what happens is if it's like for instance, we stayed in a hotel that also had the workshop, and it was what I felt was a standard approach to building safety. It was a very well done building. So somebody comes in and they build a structure like that, and they'll follow what they know from codes. But when it comes to the average building in the city, like for instance, if a building, if there was some space, or if they created a space to build a new building, oftentimes they're going to just build it based on the way they've done it for many, many hundreds of years. They use I've got photographs of the shoring that they use for the concrete floors that they build, and they really just use long tree limbs or small saplings that they'll shore up a form. Mm-hmm. And then pour the concrete, and they do have rules that they use in the country, and they've developed, and for the most part they work well for them because they really don't have a real high fire rate that they know about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the problem is and the chief that runs the whole fire service in the country expressed a need for data. Like we all do.
It always seems to come down to data or a lack of consistent data.
Yeah, and he reported like 256 deaths in a year, mm-hmm. which I think is probably maybe low,
right.
Considering that you don't get reported all the fire deaths or injuries. So so that was a critical issue.
I'd like to kind of switch gears here a little bit and go to another continent and talk about Africa, and I'd be interested in kind of the parallels that you might see, Mike, with what Dan saw down there in Africa. Again, another developing country. Just if you guys want to just talk about that a little bit and see some comparisons or differences and lessons learned in comparing how the fire department operates in those countries.
Yeah, that'd be great. And Chief Jones, we saw that in a news release that in September you and some others from North Carolina had taken the first ever civil-to-civil exchange of the State Partnership for Peace program, and this was and this particular one was between Botswana and North Carolina. You took a team with you, and then you provided and conducted a workshop for 37 fire officers from around Botswana. Obviously, this was a unique opportunity for you personally. Can you tell us about the state partnership and what that's all about?
Well, the State Partnership for Peace is a program that's a kind of a partnership thing from start to go. It got started by the State Department with individual states in the United States each being partnered with developing foreign countries. And then the program, although initiated by the State Department, is actually administered by the National Guard commands in each of the states. So, for example, in North Carolina is paired with Botswana and Moldova. And initially, this starts off as a military exchange, military to military, where they are providing some training or some technology upgrades, that sort of thing. Once the the relationship is well established, then the plan is to begin to transition it into civil-to-civil exchanges to help these emerging democracies. And in the case of Botswana, they've been working on the military-to-military for the last couple of years. And then our trip in September was the first civil-to-civil. And it was, you know, sponsored by and administered by the military. And we were hosted by the military in Botswana, the Botswana Defense Force, the BDF. But the myself and one of my fire captains, who also happens to be a master sergeant in the National Guard, were the team that were selected to go and do this training. And then it was open to both BDF and civilian senior fire officers from around the country. And so we spent a week there and provided a variety of training for them. And as you described your experience in Vietnam, Mike, this was just an incredible personal experience. And I think we learned as much as we shared.
Yeah, so I agree. And that, I think that, you know, you look at it, you're going over there to accomplish an objective, but in the back of your mind, you're thinking, wow, I'm really getting much more out of this than what I'm actually providing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let me ask you, react to this. I go over to Vietnam, and I immediately sense with colleagues from around the world that are firefighters, almost a similar, if not exact, same feeling of our camaraderie and our job.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, even the lineup board was the same. I mean, it's the same thing. I just couldn't read it because it was in Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Talk about, you know, how you felt about dealing or your impression of the fire service.
Similar reaction. The more we talked, and the two primary languages in Botswana are English and Setswana, their traditional language. So all of the Botswana people speak fluent English, and so communication was not difficult. And by the end of the first day in our workshop that we had, we were sharing stories and lamenting issues in the fire service, and their chief officers had the same concerns and issues we did. Difficulty obtaining resources from elected officials, labor problems, and dealing with labor and morale issues, technology and apparatus problems, trying to get and apply new technologies, trying to maintain apparatus fleets and get parts and preventive maintenance issues. And it, a lot of the kind of the issues were the same, and some of the stories were the same. And there is, exactly as you describe it, there's a camaraderie there, an almost immediate connection of the fire service and the similarities. And I've had other opportunities to travel to Germany and Great Britain, Scotland, places like that, and had the same experience, that the fire service has more similarity than it does differences.
Good. How do you think that's impacted you since you've come back? Has it changed or influenced your thinking about fire protection in any way?
Well, it's one of the things that's caused me to appreciate very much what we have and what we enjoy. We do a lot of complaining in the American Fire Service about lack of resources and lack of technology and equipment problems and staffing problems and all. But what I observe there and what they're doing, similar to what you observed in Hanoi, the capital city of Botswana is a city of about 350,000 people, and they protect it with three fire stations. It's built on the British model of master stations with multiple companies. And so it, you know, that like what you saw in Hanoi, their response times and the geographic area that they're covering from individual fire stations is dramatic. The other thing that I saw in Africa that that bothered me a lot was the real range of resources and capabilities. They have career fire departments in their major cities, and they have volunteer fire departments in their villages. And in the rural areas where there is no organized fire protection, the fire protection is provided by the Botswana Defense Force, the Army. They do have a wildland fire problem in Botswana during the dry season. And much of the country is very remote and very sparsely populated. And so they have real difficulties with that. They don't have any air craft for firefighting to deal with these wildland fires. Their equipment in the cities is a real mixed bag of American apparatus, older American apparatus, a European apparatus. Their equipment is built on, as I said, the Great Britain model of fire protection. They hand roll their lines. They don't have any pre-connects, similar to Great Britain. Their hydrants are underground in the city. Their rank structure is very British. They were a British protectorate up until the mid-60s when they won their independence. But if I can just for a minute speak about the country itself, one of the things that impressed me the most was the personal pride that they take in their fire service and in their country. They are a very proud people. They're proud of their democracy. They're proud of what they've accomplished and what they've built. They want to show that to you. They're very hospitable. We had one afternoon where class was over a little earlier, and our Army driver took us to the Parliament downtown and took us to the office of the President and took us to the History Museum of the country and conducted personal tours for us, took us to the monument to their first president. They're very proud of their heritage and of their freedom, their democracy, much more so than a lot of Americans are of their country. And I found that a little bothersome. They sort of like you describe in Vietnam, it ranges from very modern high-rises that have full sprinkler and alarm systems in the core of the capital city to very poor plywood shack slums on the outskirts of the city. So the fire protection problem there is the full range from wildland fire to modern high-rise firefighting.
Right. So the full range, all the above, yeah.
Everything. How they prepare for that, how they train for that. One of the things that we found interesting was in the first couple of days of class, they complained to us a lot that they needed help with their training programs, that they had no training programs, that the only training they had was when they sent people to either Hong Kong or to Great Britain for fire academies. And that they had no training facilities, nothing like organized training. But then on the third day, part of the program was we actually toured some of the fire facilities with the whole group. The Army provided buses and the whole group toured fire facilities, and we talked about it. And what we actually encountered was in the capital city of Aberon, they have a training tower, a masonry training tower. They have a masonry burn building. They have classrooms. They have some fire simulators. And we asked, we said, we thought you said that you don't have any training academies or you don't have any training facilities. And they said, oh, this is nothing. We don't have any training facilities like they have in Great Britain. Well, what they were doing was they were comparing the British Fire College at Moreton and Marsh, which most of us know is probably the premier fire training facility in the world. They were comparing Moreton and Marsh to what they had back at home in Botswana. And so we tried to explain to them that you actually have everything you need here to conduct fire academies and to, you know, provide training. And you know, what you probably need some help with is materials and curriculums and so forth. But they had all the facilities necessary. And we explained to them that there were fire departments in the United States that didn't even have what they had in the way of training towers and burn buildings and that sort of things. They almost didn't believe us. They were like, oh, no, not in America. In America, you have all this stuff. We said, no, actually, there's many fire departments in America that lack training facilities, that don't have adequate apparatus, that are operating with old equipment. And they were flabbergasted by that. They were like, no, that's not possible in America. So their perception of us is probably as far off as our perception of them was.
Well, it sounds like a follow-up trip for them to come to the United States and actually get a taste of that.
Actually, we've talked about that as a future step in the program of bringing some of their officers here, specifically to the Triangle region of North Carolina here, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill area, and have them spend some time with our personnel in our stations and participate in our training. We're looking at the possibility of taking a instructor methodology course down there and actually creating a group of fire instructors for them so that they can begin to develop their own training programs. They have a lot more resources than they give themselves credit for. They've just not had the opportunity to get very organized. In fact, we were told that this class that we did was the first time that many of these chief officers from the major cities around Botswana or major larger towns is the first time they'd all been in a room at the same time together. And so we took that opportunity one morning and we kind of got them going on the idea of forming a Botswana Fire Protection Association and began to work together on some of their issues. And so they actually asked us for an hour out of the program, and they took that hour. One of them took the front of the room, and they had a discussion, and it got very animated. And at the end of the discussion, they voted, and they created a committee to investigate creating their own fire protection association. And they asked me to send them some materials that would help them with that. So when we got back, we forwarded them constitution and bylaws from the North Carolina Fire Chiefs Association and the International Association of Fire Chiefs to give them some models to work off of. And I've heard back that they are on their way to forming their first national association to begin to work together and support each other.
And I've got a question for actually both of you guys here. I'm really curious about fire prevention. You know, we've talked about the operational aspect and some of the codes. I'm kind of wondering what they do for fire prevention activities. And maybe we can start with you, Mike, and then Dan.
Yeah, and I think that's where it comes down to their interest. And they are really interested in increasing their use of standards so that they can make consistent throughout the country the same types of safety features. They do inspect buildings when they're being constructed, and then they do actually have their form of commissioning a building to turn it over to the occupants. I think they want to strengthen that and increase that ability to have that consistency from area to area in the country. And they are following, like I said, some building construction standards that they've developed within the country. Interesting thing is that they do everything by consensus in committee, and that sounds difficult, but they actually, if somebody comes to the governing people within the country and says, you know, we have a consensus of people that think that this is an idea, they just implement it. There's not a great deal of discussion. They just go ahead and implement it. So they don't have some of the layers that we have in getting things done, but they do inspections. One of the things that they really have some problems with right now is electrical distribution, which is the cause of most of their fires. And if you, I can certainly at some point in time provide some photographs. I took a lot of these poles that have hundreds or thousands of connections and wires. These are huge bundles of wires out in the open, running down the middle of the streets, and people just climb the poles and hook their electric up. And you know, while it's illegal to do that, they still do it because there's no real really anybody out there that's enforcing these kind of things. So on that end of things, once buildings are in use, they get less and less attention from the aspect of fire and life safety and building safety.
How about education? Are they doing fire prevention education programs?
They do, but not to the degree you see in other Far East countries. I think that's one of the areas that they do want to develop, but that unfortunately wasn't a part of this particular workshop. I did have a couple people that mentioned some discussion, and we had some discussion through translator on how that might work. But I think that this is an area that really needs some attention for them to have a focus on the life safety aspect of things, and to get people in their own right to take the responsibility for fire safety.
How about Botswana, Dan? What are they doing for fire prevention and fire safety education over there?
Well, it was not real clear to us. We had some discussions with them about that. In the larger cities, they do fire inspections. It was not clear what authority or code they were using to do that by. But they do inspections in the larger cities. In the villages and the outlying areas, there is no code enforcement or inspections. And it was pretty clear to us from what we observed that there probably is very little code application, particularly outside of the core of the cities. Now, when you were in the downtown areas of the larger cities, it was like any developed nation, and a lot of the buildings had sprinkler systems and alarm systems, and it was clear that they had sufficient exiting. And at least in their design and building process, there's obviously some influence there to promote safety and kind of best practices, but it's not widespread. As far as public education goes, we had all the major cities or towns represented in the class, and about half of them indicated that they did public education programs. And in some cases, they had they actually showed us, and what they had done is they had taken some of the open public education programs you can find on the internet from the United States or Great Britain, and were using applications of those and in the schools and that sort of thing. But it's really fledgling. It's in the beginning stages of their effort. And it appears to be driven by the individual dedication of some staff officers who see that as a way to deal with a fire problem. One of the things that struck me, particularly in Oberon, the capital city, which, as I said, is 350,000 people, was like Mike. We asked him about their service demand and incident volume. Their dispatch records are kept in a handwritten logbook, like they were in this country 60 to 80 years ago. And they have no idea of their data or statistics. They do provide rescue services, vehicle extrication services, and they do provide what I would describe as advanced life support. EMS is run at least from some of the larger fire departments. But they really don't have any record keeping. They don't keep statistics or data. They don't file individual reports. It's handwritten into a logbook. So I asked one of the operations officers there to give me an idea how many calls they went. So he basically took the logbook from their dispatch, and their dispatch operation consists of two firefighters sitting in front of three telephones and a base radio, and that's their dispatch for the entire city. And he kind of flipped back through the logbook and counted calls, and over a couple of week period, it looked like they averaged about 8 calls in a 24-hour period for a city of 350,000 people.
Now, was that 8? That's not 8 working fires, is it?
Or
is
no, no, that's 8 calls for service, including vehicle accidents and that sort of thing. And they indicated that their biggest problem is vehicle accidents and vehicle extrications, particularly on Fridays when people are paid. They have a significant alcohol problem with driving.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, they said on Fridays, they have a lot of vehicle accidents caused by alcohol, and they have a lot of extrications. But no, they don't have the working fires that you would expect, at least not in the cities, for that size of population and for the densities. And yet they don't have code enforcement and the public education either that you could point to offset that. So it's a little bit mind-boggling how you could have that many people in that dense of setting and not have any more call volume than they have.
Well, I think the, you know, and listening to both of you talk about your trips over there, and I've been overseas as well and seen some of the international fire service, you know, on both ends of the spectrum, there's so much to be learned in both directions. You know, we have a lot to learn from them in terms of making do with limited resources and doing a good job, perhaps like you're saying there in Botswana. You know, they don't have the resources we're so used to over here, yet, you know, their fire volume's low. Versus other countries that, you know, just...
Their resources over there, Ed, range from very modernistic multi-bay fire stations that would be the pride of any major city in the United States, mm-hmm. on the upper end, to the lower end of being a single concrete block room with no running water, power, anything like that, as the fire station with two 30-year-old fire trucks parked outdoors under a metal cabana.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the range of their fire service.
Yeah.
It literally is the full spectrum.
I think that's a statement that could describe Vietnam as well. It's just a whole range of things, and I think that they really want to. They have a strong desire to improve and build their service. So, you know, that's a good starting point. They want a professional service, which they're doing right now, but they can get better.
Oh, same thing in Botswana, Mike. Just a tremendous desire to learn and improve, and they were like sponges, even on the breaks when we would take a break. And being a former British colony, obviously we had to have tea at breaks, and so we had tea in the morning and the afternoon and so forth. But even on the tea breaks and so forth, I mean, they would buttonhole us and just ask a million questions and ask us to send them information on a variety of things, from hazardous materials handling to fire inspections to training to incident command. Their appetite for knowledge was literally insatiable.
Well, I appreciate both of you taking the time, and I wish we had more time, because I know there's so much more that you guys did over there. I've been talking to both of you, and we're going to put some links on the page here where people can get some more information about fire safety in both countries, and also some other international reports and information that's out there. There is a lot of information out there. I think these exchange programs you went on are just real eye-openers for the fire service on both sides, so I'd just like to pass on my appreciation for both doing it, but also sharing this information, because I think it's great for us to hear about how it's being done in other parts of the world, and we can learn from them and they can learn from us. So appreciate you joining us. We've been talking with Division Chief Mike Love from Montgomery Fire and Rescue Services and Chief Dan Jones from Chapo Fire Department, who went overseas to both Vietnam and Botswana on separate trips there. And thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Ed.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Well, joining us with us now, Mike, is Mark Gilarducci, who is a vice president of WIT Associates out of Washington, D.C. Mark is actually out of the Western office, and thanks for joining us, Mark.
Happy to be here.
All right. Before we do start, there's somebody I'd like to mention that we all know, we've all worked with in the past, who just passed away, unfortunately. Dr. Guilaine Proulx from the National Research Council of Canada. She did a lot of work in human behavior in fires, one of the international experts in this whole field, and she passed away very quickly from cancer at only 48. And boy, the loss of her is just going to be tremendous. You know, Mark and I had a chance to work with her a number of years ago on the Cook County fire, and boy, the insight she brought to that fire was just unbelievable, Mark, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. She was really, you know, one of the best that she, you know, in her field, and what a great person to work with, and she was very passionate about what she did.
And you've known her too, haven't you, Mike? You've run in with her and done projects and stuff like that as well, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. And again, it's going to be a big loss to Phil. Certainly, our condolences.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you just Google her name, you know, her publications, her writing, she's just been so prolific in putting our information out there. So really unfortunate. You know, it's a real loss for the world of fire safety. And she's one of those people that a lot of people on the line probably don't know her, but she's made their lives safer. There's no two ways about it. So it's just a huge loss.
Yeah. Well, you had an excellent Fire Marshal's Corner with her early on in the stages of developing this program.
Yes, I did. She was one of the first people I interviewed, and she's also been in several articles I've done in Campus Firewatch and things like that. Just the depth of her knowledge is just unbelievable. It just really was. So a real loss, but she's one of those people, in the short time that she was with us, she has made such a huge difference in the world, and there aren't many people that can say that, but she really, really did. So, you know, I'm very sad to see her go. It's a very big, huge loss. Yeah. Well, the reason we asked Mark to join us is a few years ago, Mark had the opportunity to go over to Russia and meet with them and look at the emergency preparedness and the fire response in that country. And the reason we're having him on is rather timely, given the fire that just happened to the Lame Horse Club in, I guess, the city of Perm is the name of it over there in Russia, where as of this morning, the fire death is 124 people. Mm. And, you know, all we have to go on right now are really the media reports, but it sounds like a lot of parallels, actually, to the Station Nightclub fire. Pyrotechnics were lit off in the club. Apparently, the place was decorated. And again, we have to qualify this. You know, it's from media reports, but they used a lot of twigs and branches and things like that to decorate the ceiling. And it was also called some sort of plastic ceiling. So it sounds like some parallels to the Station Nightclub fire, and actually some parallels back to Coconut Grove on this fire. So there'll be a lot more information coming out on that over the next few weeks, I'm sure. But, Mark, you know, I was wondering if you could maybe fill us in on your trip over there, you know, what you learned, what you saw, what your impressions were of fire safety and emergency preparedness in Russia.
Sure. Yeah, you know, the nightclub fire, you know, I think speaks to one of the key challenges that the Russians are sort of dealing with, and that is this whole issue of codes and standards. And, you know, they have a lot of infrastructure and building stock that's older, and you know, these nightclubs, you know, get established or these buildings get built, people move in, and they don't have necessarily the best fire codes in place. And I know that, you know, there's been several opportunities where the Russian Fire Service has come out and met with us. I've done some training with their firefighters, and, you know, they are really trying to, you know, develop a greater capability for dealing with these kinds of situations. But, you know, in reality, outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, where, you know, you've got a large population and you know, you've got a lot of government representation, so there's a little bit more effort with funding and support to develop a fire service that's pretty modern. You know, the further you go out from there, it's pretty austere, and the fire service generally are lacking in everything from, you know, incident command capabilities and the understanding of basic fire suppression techniques and how to sort of address fire suppression issues to, you know, equipment, you know, basic equipment, both in their suppression capability, their engines, and their PPE. All of those are you know, sort of they have what they have. They do the best they can. Some of the folks lack training, so they basically do what they can. So, you know, it really depends on the parts of Russia you're in. But I know that you know, one of the first things they've been trying to address is this issue of trying to put better codes in place and actually enforcement of the codes, which is, of course, we all know, one of the biggest. You could have the codes, but if they're not enforced, that's an issue. So. My effort there, my trip there, and meeting with folks from Moscow and St. Petersburg, I ended up touring all through the far eastern portion of a place called Vladivostok, which, again, the infrastructure itself, in some cases where the communities are in place, they don't even have water systems that could be able to provide, you know, water flow during for fire suppression activities. And so when you look at the compendium of issues that they face and, you know, you tie it all together, it's quite daunting for them to be able to figure out, you know, how do you get a comprehensive modern fire service capability. And so, you know, they try to address it piece by piece. You know, I talk about the sort of the Russian army approach. You know, right, in many cases their strategy is to just keep throwing people at it. You know, it's kind of the Russian army approach, to keep throwing people at the problem until the problem gets solved. But the problem is that you have firefighter safety issues or rescuer safety issues, and you know, inadvertently you lose the fire service folks trying to do the best job that they can because of the lack of standards and safety and equipment. And you know, they learn big events like the Chernobyl reactor meltdown and other events that they've had now, you know, particularly with some of this terrorist activity, where they know that they're putting firefighters at risk. And many of the delegations that have come to my office in California have been very, very interested in trying to find out more about how to put safety standards in place and how to recognize the kinds of threats that firefighters face during these types of events. And we've talked a lot about incident command and also about, you know, the kind of PPE you need. So, you know, it's a very interesting place. You know, certainly in the major metropolitan cities, Moscow and St. Petersburg, you see a much greater capability. But as I said, as you go out in these concentric rings further out into the country, it gets much, much less, and it's very inconsistent.
Now, is it a national fire service?
It is. There's a national, you know, the higher level government, central government has a fire service capability. And then there's also fire service that all comes down to the local level. And there's some funding or there's some, you know, equipment that's provided by the central government to the local governments. But in some of those cases, I mean, we're talking about local entities that either volunteer or they may have some, you know, government or quasi-military in fire service engagement, but mostly for the day-to-day stuff, the EMS calls and the basic fire suppression activity at the local level, it's sort of a local capability. And then if the thing gets to be a big event, then they can call upon the central government for additional assistance.
Now one of the things in another portion of the show, Mike talked about his trip to Vietnam. And I remember one of the things Mike mentioning was, even though it's a different country and different language, you know, a lot of the things are still the same when it comes to, you know, the firefighters, their attitudes, their willingness, their desire. I mean, did you find that in Russia as well?
Absolutely, you know? Yeah. There's no question about that. I mean, as well, you know, I recently traveled through Indonesia, the fire service. I just came back from a trip to China. I mean, the fire service across the world, you know, all of them have the same sort of character, interest, commitment to trying to do the right thing. And, you know, they're an improvise, overcome sort of culture. So, you know, even with minimal equipment or minimal safety, you know, they're still going to do what firefighters do, and that's, you know, rescue people and try to, you know, mitigate whatever emergency they're faced with, whatever the emergency is. And I think that the gap that exists, you know, across the world is, you know, certainly in the area of knowledge and training. And you know, once you get that gap filled, and, you know, the rest can sort of come along. But I think that, you know, as far as the culture of the fire service, I agree 100%. I mean, all of them, you know, it's a brotherhood. When I arrived in these countries, when I arrived in Russia, it was, you know, immediate acceptance, and we felt very, very comfortable with each other. We went to the firehouses and, you know, did all the kinds of things that you do in the fire service. So it's good. I got a lot of paraphernalia. You know, we exchange a lot of things. But yeah. I love that because it's really what it's all about, and that melts away any sort of, you know, sort of concern or whatever. We immediately are on the same page with regards to the issues that both of us face. We just look at it from a little bit different perspective, and I think from the area of, you know, experience and knowledge and training really is, like I say, that gap that fills that. So if we can help them, and certainly we have and we can, that's where we can help that exchange of information.
Well, you know, it is amazing, you know, that instant connection, and Dan Jones, fire chief in Chapel Hill, mentioned that on his conversation with us earlier, and it transcends. It just happens, and it's really a comfortable feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mark, I wanted to ask you something. You know, there's, I think, a trend happening, and of course, you know, with the changes in what formerly was the USSR and the individualizing of all those countries over there that used to be part of the whole coalition, they are having a pretty high rate of fire death. And this is certainly nothing new. And I don't know what the latest statistics are for, say, 2008, but it looked like somewhere around early in this decade, they were Russia in particular was suffering somewhere around 6.5 people per 100,000 population. Well, that's a lot of fire deaths.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? It looks like some of the other Eastern Europe countries are also Estonia 14 per 100,000, Latvia 10 per 100,000. What is going on, do you think, in some of these countries?
Well, from my travels and assessment, you know, it really is, you know, infrastructure, you know, surrounding infrastructure, the type of buildings are very old. There's lack of fire suppression systems. There's lack of fire alert and warning systems. Their prevention, you know, efforts are minimal. I mean, they're just kind of coming up to speed, really understanding all that. But when you look at the, you know, many of these now new state governments that were formerly part of the USSR, you know, are now, you know, sort of building their own capacities, and they sort of inherited all of this old infrastructure. And I don't think there's huge fire public education programs there either. And you know, and so people don't really understand that. You see people cooking in open flames in their homes. I mean, open fire, and it's cultural to some extent. So, you know, those are all. That's why I kind of started off by saying, you know, one of their greatest challenges, I think, is this whole issue of codes and standards and what the future is going to look like. Now, if you go to Moscow, where they have some modern buildings, you're going to see, you know, hotels which and modern office buildings that have addressed some of these issues, but that doesn't account for the so many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of buildings and homes that just don't have any capability.
And I mean, it's you know, you bring up the other parts of the world, you know, it's. I mean, I'm looking at some of the stats now, and Mike was referencing some of them earlier too. It's kind of all over the map, and I think part of it too is we all look at fire a little differently, and we catalog it differently, and the approach is certainly different. But there's certainly a lot to be learned, even from the countries that are doing it, you know, are having such a terrible problem. You know, they're trying to make do with limited resources, you know. Mm. Here we are in this country, we're very lucky in that we do have a lot of resources, yet our fire deaths are so incredibly high as well. You know, you look at some of these other countries that just, you know, they don't have much to work with and are doing the best they can, and there's probably something we can learn from there about how to do with limited resources.
Well, you know, for example, I mean, I just came back from China. You know, the Chinese have finally realized that, you know, it's in their best interest to implement more comprehensive fire and emergency services capabilities, and so they're on a big effort now in building, you know, all sorts of not only fire suppression and prevention systems, but enhanced capability and increasing the training of firefighters, increasing the PPE of firefighters, and expanding expanding their level of understanding so that they could respond to a more all hazard environment. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Russians, from my experience, have want that as well. I mean, I've had delegations from the Ukraine and from Moscow and, like I said, from the eastern part of Russia and Vladivostok, both me going there and then them coming to California, and they desperately want to learn about incident command, and they want to learn about the best sort of strategies to be able to address some of these things. But it's got to start small and continue to progress out, and it has to be a culture that sort of supports that overall effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been, there's so much more that we can learn, so much more that we can talk about to you. And I think we're going to have Mark back on a future show to talk about some of his other travels. We just don't have that much time on this one, in terms of how other parts of the world are dealing with fire safety, what we can learn from them and what we can teach them. I think these outreach things that are just exceptional. And I mentioned the other portions of the show. Mike is talking about his trip to Vietnam, Dan Jones with his trip to Botswana. Mm. And really, this internationalization or this exchange of information across borders just helps all of us tremendously in terms of trying to improve fire safety, in terms of what we can learn back and forth. So we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, Mark. And as I said, I hope you'll come back again when we can talk a little bit more time about some of the rest of your travels.
Okay, guys. Well, good talking with you all as well, and have a happy holidays, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Well, Mike, this was a pretty good show that we had this month, wasn't it? Again, the international show with all these people we had talking, including yourself.
Absolutely. We're just one small community when it comes down to it, and are faced with the same challenges and problems that everybody has around the world. Some of us are a little more advanced in one area, but certainly have almost mirrored problems as other parts of the world as well. So this was really fascinating, and look forward to us being able to do more of this in the future.
And I think we definitely will, as we said during our interview with Mark, we definitely want to have him back to talk more in depth about his trip to China, which is just, that part of the world is just really taking off in so many areas and facing so many of the same challenges that we all are. So I think we're definitely going to have him back on a future show. So, hey, glad you could join us this month on Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Camo, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Mike Love. Thanks for joining us, and take care.
See you all later.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.